Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to be talking about the opiate problem in this country, and it is substantial. According to new reports, between 50,000 to 65,000 Americans die each year from opioids. It's been called a national crisis. We're going to have two guests with us this hour of the program. Sam Quiñones is with us the first half hour, author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He's a veteran journalist and expert storyteller and has done very thorough investigative work of the spread of heroin addiction throughout the United States over the past two decades. He's interviewed addicts and their relatives, Mexican farm boys turned entrepreneurs, narco bosses, doctors, public health personnel. And the book looks at how the underground drug culture of addiction surged with the complicity of the medical profession and also of big pharma. And he will be with us the first half hour of the program. We'll center on Wisconsin, the second half of the program. Representative John Nygren will join us. He's a Republican state representative from Marinette. And heroin and opioid prevention is one of his key issues. He has been spearheading legislation on this since 2014. There were another set of bills that he spearheaded through the legislature in April of this year as well. Part of the reason for his deep interest and concern and activist work on this is the addiction problems that his daughter has faced. So that's the hour. And I know this affects a lot of people. I anticipate we'll have quite a few phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Sam, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. How are you doing?
I'm good, Sam. And I must confess to you, I normally read the books before the interview, but we knew we were doing this topic yesterday, and Nancy Pearl, the wonderful librarian, was on our show, and we were talking about book recommendations, and she talked about your book so highly that I thought, you know, I read whatever she tells me to read, so I thought we have to get him on the program, so I'll be late in reading your book, but I've read about it, and she just thinks it's it's one of the best nonfiction books she's read in a long time, so.
Well, it's very nice for her. I hope you like it when you do.
Yeah, I'm sure that I will. And so what I read about it is absolutely fascinating. Let's go to the city of Portsmouth, Ohio, where you anchor the book. What was going on in Portsmouth, Ohio in the 1990s, Sam?
Well, Portsmouth, Ohio is really part of a much larger story that takes place beginning in the late 80s and revving up through the 1990s, in which we have a revolution in pain management in American medicine. And that's ignited first by a pain specialist. They're young doctors, a lot of them. Pain specialty is a new specialty at that point, relatively speaking. And they believe that we are not treating pain very well. I think they were right about that. And they came up with the idea, they believed that we had the tools to treat that pain very effectively, but we're afraid to use them. And these pills were a narcotic prescription painkiller, known by the brands Percocet, Lortab, Vicodin, and then later OxyContin. They began to push this idea. They were joined, as all this was going on, by the pharmaceutical companies, a lot of which made these different pills. And they formed a very effective megaphone, you might say, where the pharmaceutical companies' money and the independence, really, of the pain specialists kind of served to gather momentum towards the idea that we are a country in an epidemic of pain, that we were we're not treating it effectively, and we had the tools to treat it effectively, but we're afraid to use them because we erroneously, science now knew, that these pills would not addict people who were pain patients, even though they were narcotics from the opium poppy, essentially opiates, basically. And this began to gain a lot of momentum. A lot of promotion took place, mostly in the area, the ground zero for all this, I would say, certainly the major players is you know, with Columbus, Ohio to the north, Cincinnati to the west, most of West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, those areas very, very roughly drawn. At the center of all that is the town of Portsmouth, Ohio, at the center of that map, essentially. It's a southern Ohio town on the Kentucky, with the bordering of Kentucky on the Ohio River. And that town by then had gone through what basically was the Rust Belt Syndrome. It had lost a lot of its jobs. It lost a steel mill, a lot of shoe factories, a lot of its population, about half its population had left. Main Street had crumbled. A lot of that was basically killed off finally by Walmart that moved to town and took all of the business with it. And by the time this opiate promotion kind of came around, this town was extraordinarily vulnerable. The town itself had been anchored by this gorgeous, enormous football field-sized swimming pool that kind of kept the community together, and it's where people grew up together, and everyone spent the summer there. And with all this, the decline of the town, the pool closed. The name of the pool was Dreamland, which is, I titled my book. And with all that, it becomes kind of the center of what's called the pill mill. The pill mill is a kind of a business run by doctors, a pain clinic. Really, it's a pain clinic, though, that in which really there's no diagnosis of pain. It's really a pretense for just essentially selling prescriptions. And these pill mills are essentially invented. That business is essentially invented in the town of Portsmouth, Ohio. And from there it spreads. And as part of that, it was heavily affected by this opiate promotion that was going on at the same time in that region. And the town essentially becomes an entire generation becomes addicted to opiate painkillers through that.
Oh, how sad. I find it hard to understand why there weren't a lot of red flags raised by a lot of people distributing these pills widely. Why didn't some people, you know, pipe up and say, wait a second, these are narcotics. Addiction is a very possible thing that could happen.
And I think a lot of doctors did, or a lot of doctors were skeptical. But there was this drumbeat, we're a country in pain. And I think part of it, honestly, was that Americans wanted easy answers to pain. This was a time when I believe we had won the Cold War. We wanted to kind of kick back. We wanted ease. We wanted comfort. We wanted quick answers to complicated problems after dealing with such a complicated thing as a Cold War for the previous 50 years. I mean, I think there was a lot of societal issues as well as a kind of an economic interest by pharmaceutical companies in pushing these pills as the answer. Finally, also, insurance companies begin to cut back on other kinds of pain treatment. There's a variety of ways of treating pain, and usually you have to use many of those to treat one person's pain, unless, of course, you treat it all with a narcotic painkiller. The problem is, of course, none of those other strategies or treatments lead so quickly to addiction as do opiate painkillers. And so it was a drumbeat. Time magazine wrote stories about how pain was killing people. There was this widespread belief that we had we were in an epidemic of pain and that we needed to treat it very, very aggressively. There were a lot of people in pain. There were a lot of people who were not having their pain treated well. All of that was true. And so this was viewed as a way of very quickly and cheaply getting that done. A lot of people did object. A lot of people went away from meetings or conferences or seminars or continuing medical education seminars thinking, what the heck are they talking about? Because every doctor had learned and of course, through history, we have 5,000 years plus history with the opium poppy, and what we know is that it has two very, very potent qualities. One, it is a magnificent painkiller, and number two, it is magnificent at addicting humans.
Right.
But we began to believe that now we knew better, that now science knew that this was not the case, you know.
Oh, it's so sad what happened, and now you have a whole group of other people who are hooked on this. You've got, as you write, football players, you've got cheerleaders, you've got Rush Limbaugh.
Right, and that's what the thing. It became so widespread because this was the first time that a drug problem starts really not with with street drug dealers, not with street mafias,
right,
but with doctors believing something that wasn't always true, and in order to help us with our supposed pain, or our real or supposed pain. And now young doctors often tell me this. They are frequently faced with patients that did not start with them, but patients come to them demanding they're on very, very high doses of opioids, 600, 700, 800 milligrams a day, whatever it would be. And they are very difficult to deal with. They demand, they cry, they threaten. You get a real weariness on the part of a lot of younger doctors who don't know what to do because they've got so many patients who are just simply demanding these drugs. And in time, that became part of the problem, that a lot of people, once they began using these drugs, were terrified of going off of them, were clearly in the doctor's mind. I've talked to many doctors who are just have no doubt that many of their patients are full-fledged addicts to these drugs, cannot stop. Yet the drugs don't seem to really increase their quality of life. The pain may stop, but there's a lot of other things that you can't remember things day to day. Your sex drive dies. You eat poorly. A lot of other quality of life things fall off. And so now we're in a situation, and this is, of course, across the country because doctors, sure, this became accepted practice all across America, where we have now many, many patients who are using huge amounts of these drugs every day.
Yes. And some of these pills aren't as available and doctors not as willing to prescribe them because of what's happened. So then you go into this influx of, as you write, cheap Mexican black tar heroin supplied by, and this is quite a story, a unique and very effective small business model by the Jalisco boys, from young men from the same small agricultural town in the state of Nayarit, close to an opium poppy producing area. So heroin becomes an alternative?
Right. And the reason for that is that, there's a few reasons. One is, though, that doctors not knowing frequently how to deal now with these patients who are clearly out of balance and need, and so a lot of doctors just simply say, okay, I'm not prescribing to you anything, you're cut off, I'm firing you as a patient, that kind of thing.
Right.
And a lot of those people. What also happened, though, and the guys that you referred to that I read about in the book were a big, big part of this, is that we had a switch in our heroin market in the 1980s. And before the 1980s, lots and lots of our heroin came from the Far East, from Turkey, Burma, Thailand, places like that. When in the 1980s, all that changed. That heroin was coming to the United States very weak and very expensive. It got here. It was not a good product from the addict's point of view. Mexican and Colombian heroin began to outcompete that through the 1980s. And by the end of the 1980s, early 1990s, virtually all our heroin was supplied by folks from Mexico or Colombia. And today it's almost all entirely Mexican heroin. The guys that I write about were important in this story because, first of all, they developed a system of selling heroin retail that's very much like pizza delivery. So you the addict call a number, they dispatch a driver who's tooling around your town with a bunch of little balloons of heroin in his mouth, comes to meets you, delivers the dope that way, and goes on. And this guys from this one town expanded through many states in the United States. Their importance, however, is even more than that. And that is that they were the first traffickers to figure out that and then systematically exploit the enormous potential coming market for heroin, that this overprescribing, that this pain revolution and this overprescribing of pain pills represented. They figured that out because they landed by pure coincidence in Columbus, Ohio in 1998, back when this pain revolution and this pill promotion and all this stuff was really beginning to rev very hot. And from then on, they followed the pills. They didn't go to New York City. They'd never been to Baltimore or Philadelphia, which are our classic heroin markets. They went to where the pills were. So they went to Indianapolis and Nashville and Memphis and Charlotte and Minneapolis and so on and on like that. Virgin markets, they began to figure that out, that if you just simply follow the pills, that you will have a huge new market. And they'd never seen this before. They had been working on this system for 15, 20 years by then. They've been doing it in L.A. and so on. But every place they'd gone in the western United States up to that point had really had a static number of addicts. And so they were kind of always fighting over this group of, say, 200 addicts in the town of Salt Lake, for example, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
They come east just as this pill revolution is exploding. And they're right there, and they're on the ground. They're selling retail. They figured this out very, very quickly. Now what's happened, though, is that these guys who were the innovators who figured this out, think about this, 20 years ago they knew this was going to happen, and they were on it. But today, you know, there's the underworld. There's no business licenses. There's no regulation. So now they were the big fish in a small pond, and many small ponds around the country. Now those ponds are enormous. Oceans, and they still practice, but many other traffickers from Mexico primarily are involved now, and they're supplying huge amounts to Chicago, and from Chicago it goes all over the place, goes to Milwaukee, goes to Madison and so on, goes to other parts in Iowa. So no longer do you have these guys as kind of like the only right. Players and or the primary players on the market. Many, many people have entered the market now.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls for Sam. Sam Quiñones is our guest. His book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Our number is 800-486-8655. Duke in West Dallas, our first caller for you, Sam. Hi, Duke.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Can't hear you real well, but let's try.
Okay, can you hear me now?
That's better. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I lived in Madison during the 80s and 90s, and I'm living down in Milwaukee now, and I've known a lot of addicts. I've known a lot of addicts that used to travel all the way from Madison to Milwaukee just to get their methadone. And what I'm trying to figure out is why is it an epidemic now that it's affecting the middle-class people and a lot of white people when it wasn't an epidemic before?
It's an epidemic now because unprecedented numbers of people have died from this. The New York Times published a story a little bit ago that estimated that in 2016, once all the cases are finally counted, there will be something on the order of 59,000 people nationwide who will have died from this. That's more than all the soldiers we lost in the Vietnam War, in the entire length of the Vietnam War. I would say that this story, on the contrary, has not gotten the attention it has deserved. It's been festering for 20 years. It's not gotten the attention it deserves because primarily it started out in Appalachia in the Rust Belt areas, but mostly it's affected middle and upper middle class people. And the reason I say that is because a lot of those families wanted it kept quiet. They did not want their people to know how their loved one, their brother, their son, their daughter, their aunt really died. It was very much like the AIDS epidemic. You would have people inventing causes of death, heart attack at age 25. And nobody really wanting to talk publicly about it. This is what I found as recently as 2013, 2014, when I was writing my book. I would be out there. I knew that the death toll was high and rising every year. And still, I could not find many parents who wanted to talk about this. Crack was a major headline problem for a decade. I was a reporter in the crack days, and I remember it very, very, very vividly. It was a big part of my career and my life covering that stuff. And for a decade, we saw crack on 60 Minutes and on Time Magazine and et cetera, all over. You never heard the end of it. This is only in the last 2 years have people actually begun to actually pay attention and cover this regularly and be on top of it as news organizations. Up to that point, nobody did this. Your organization didn't. Nobody's did. And so, and the reason for that is, I believe, that back then people didn't want to talk about it. Everyone was mortified, very ashamed at how their child died. Sure. Their child was found with a needle his arm on a bathroom toilet at McDonald's. And now we don't have that. Now we have people breaking away and opening up and breaking out of the shadows, talking about this in ways that are very public. And that's why we now have recognized something that has actually been festering in the silence since the late 90s.
Thanks very much for the call. Rick in Monona. Hi.
Yes, I'm really interested in this. My mother was a victim of a pill epidemic 2 times during her life when she was still living. The first one was back in the early 60s when she got hooked on the miracle drug, which were diet pills.
Mm.
And she got a hook so badly that she, when she couldn't get them, she actually started calling in her own prescriptions.
Mm.
And eventually got arrested and spent time in prison for it. And then many years later, back in the early 2000s, her doctor prescribed OxyContin, this new miracle drug for pain, that she had some kind of a pain in her side that was constant. And it didn't take long before she was addicted to that. And I heard what your guest said about they go to doctors and plead. Well, she ran out one time, and I remember she called me and pleaded with me on the phone to go get her a prescription for that. So I actually called the doctor. I said, she needs it. So I was sort of taken in by it. But nobody, I think, back then knew about the power of these things. They are indeed powerful. She ended up taking all of those pills, and I'm sure it wasn't for suicide. I think she was just out of it and spent a long time in the hospital recovering from it. So this is serious business. These miracle drugs really need to be monitored closely.
Oh, what a story. I'm sorry. That was a hard one, Rick. Sam?
Yes, yes, Rick. I'm sorry as well. This sounds brutal. I would say one thing. It sounds to me like your mother, kind of her life, charted closely with the emergence of pharmaceutical advertising. Back in the 60s is when the pharmaceutical company industry achieved its first miracle, a billion-dollar drug eventually became a billion, and that was Valium. And it corresponds very closely with the liberalization of pharmaceutical marketing and new strategies that the pharmaceutical industry has. In the 1950s, it was very careful not to do much of that, and it was a very gray industry. And then, beginning with Valium, and then, of course, these diet pills and some others you could mention, they become far more aggressive and far more personal, visiting doctors all the time, in constant contact through mail or a variety of ways with doctors. And then you fast forward to the mid-1990s when OxyContin comes out, and all of those strategies are put in place for OxyContin. In fact, the company that produces OxyContin is still owned by the Sackler family. Three Sackler brothers bought it. The primary brother, Arthur Sackler, I talk about a lot in the book, is one of the great pioneers of pharmaceutical marketing techniques, and he's in the pharmaceutical marketing Hall of Fame. And he's dead. He died in 1987. But his strategies of personal contact with the doctors, constant drug rep visits and all that kind of giving away free supply, free samples and this kind of thing, and constantly buttering up the staff and this kind of thing. That all of that was used very, very aggressively by Purdue Pharma when it came out with OxyContin. So your mother's life, it seems to me, charted kind of fairly closely with the emergence and the liberalization of pharmaceutical marketing in this country. And we now see that, of course, every day on TV with these ridiculous ads that are on TV all the time. Why that's allowed, I'm not quite sure, but it shows you the power of pharmaceutical companies know the power of marketing better than anybody now.
Absolutely. So what's the availability and the regulation of these kinds of drugs now, Sam?
Oh, they're easy. I mean, if you can get a doctor to prescribe them for you, they're you can get them. OxyContin is still out there. Vicodin. Percocet, all these drugs you can get. And in fact, the truth is, these drugs do have a role in medicine. That role just is not in to be in every medicine cabinet in America. And be, you know, part of the problem was we began to believe, doctors began to believe this idea that these pills were virtually not non-addictive when used to treat pain. There was a corollary to that, and that was if they're virtually non-addictive, then it doesn't matter how many of them you prescribe. And so many of your listeners, this will probably happen to you, go in for minor surgery, a couple of days in the hospital at the most, appendix, something like that. Mm-hmm. I had my appendix out. This happened to me. You're given a few of these pills in the hospital, which is where you should be given them. They're very effective painkillers, and there's a small window of pain in which during which you should get these pills, seems to me. When I'm leaving the hospital, I'm prescribed 30 days worth of these pills, Vicodin in this case, and to take home with me, right, with the admonition, take as needed. No explanation, no discussion of, you know, this might be something you may want to be very careful about. The message in that bottle, the message in that bottle was, go ahead and take as many as you want, as you need to, because they're non-addictive. We now know that. Well, it's nonsense. What right. also happened is lots of these pills ended up in medicine cabinets, unused, and from there, they leaked into the black market. Kids stole them, workers stole them, whatever.
Right. One more call for you. Same topic, then we're just switching guests. We go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. It seems to me that the pharmaceutical, my understanding is the pharmaceutical companies were well aware that these were highly addictive drugs, and they kept pushing them as not being dangerous, not being addictive to physicians and encouraging physicians to prescribe more and more and more of them. This seems to me like a very parallel case to the big tobacco companies claiming that tobacco was not harmful to health. And finally, the states woke up and brought class action suits against the tobacco companies and won. Isn't it time for class action suits against the pharmaceutical companies?
Well, that's kind of what you're seeing now. You're seeing the state of Mississippi, state of Ohio, I believe Massachusetts or counties in Massachusetts, upstate New York. There's counties and states that are beginning to go exactly that route. There is a difference, though, that may be a problem with this. And that is that these pills were prescribed exactly according to accepted medical practice at the time. And that is something that's a very big hurdle to get over when a pharmaceutical company can argue, look, people were prescribing these things exactly as everyone said they should. And that is true, that people were saying, no, this is now how we need to prescribe these pills. We need to get very aggressive with pain. And this became taught in medical schools. Part of the problem is the promotion that they did was for about 6-7 years. The first 7 years of OxyContin's life that was done was promoted in this way. Then they stopped, and they no longer make these claims. And they've been sued criminally and pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of misbranding. But part of the problem, what they created with that, though, is an entire culture of doctors and also now patients who are used to prescribing those pills on the part of doctors. And then when the doctors rebel against the idea or question the idea, they're met by patients now who are demanding these pills and insisting and getting very irate and creating lots of tension in the doctor's office when they do that. And so now there's the thing has kind of gone beyond, I think, a lot of what started it. And now you have a culture that's kind of self-perpetuating in hospitals and medical clinics and patient homes all across America now. Mm.
Sam, thank you ever so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Sam Quiñones, he's a journalist and author of Dreamland, the book that we've been talking about, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. He was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times from 2004 to 2014. Continuing this conversation with Representative John Nygren in just a moment, and we'll hear about him and all of his efforts and the legislation passed as a result of his efforts in the state of Wisconsin. This is the Ideas Network. Representative John Nygren is a Republican from Assembly District 89, Marinette. Several years ago, he introduced a number of bills addressing the opiate and heroin addiction problem in the state of Wisconsin, and he has continued to do so since those years. Another series of bills was passed just in April of this past year. Part of this was a response to his daughter's struggles, and many other families have experienced similar struggles in the state of Wisconsin. Actually, in the very small community of Marinette. We'll find out why as we speak with Representative John Nygren. Thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. You look at the extent of the problem in Marinette, which is a small community, and it really had a significant problem. Is it mostly, Representative Nygren, because of one doctor who was selling a lot of pills who went to prison for this, or was it something else?
We believe that's the main reason why Marinette kind of stood out before the rest of the state did, and it was a bigger problem there than at least initially we believed in other communities throughout the state. We had a doctor in the mid-2000s selling prescriptions. We're right on the border of Michigan. He was a doctor that was doing business in Menominee, Michigan. He was selling prescriptions for OxyContin, created a supply. He ended up going to federal prison for 3 years, lost his license, yet he had created a culture of addiction in my hometown. So that's why Marinette was seen early on as a target for this problem. We led the state in overdose deaths per capita a few years in a row. So as you mentioned, it unfortunately affected a lot of families, including my own.
Our guest the previous half hour was talking about the statistics from 2016 that 59,000 people died from opiate addiction and heroin addiction in this country in the year 2016. That seems like such a huge number of people. And in Wisconsin, the statistics are similarly alarming, aren't they?
Yeah, Wisconsin, you know, early on, so for me personally, especially when it hits your own home, you think you're unique, then we find it's a Marinette problem, then we think our community is unique, then we think Northeast Wisconsin is unique, then Wisconsin's unique. No, we're not unique. This is a trend we've been seeing, and I caught a little bit of your previous guest. This is not something that any state in our country is immune from. This is not something that any family is immune from. We early on, the heroin was a lot of the focus on the efforts in Wisconsin, but the more and more we delved into it, the more we realized that a vast majority of these people that have become heroin addicts started with prescription drugs. So, you know, there's a stigma associated with heroin, rightfully so, yet there is not that stigma with popping that pill that the doctor may have prescribed.
Right.
Even if it was for another condition.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a difficult problem, isn't it? As you remind us, oftentimes a younger person, maybe they've gone to a treatment center for a while, or maybe they've gone to prison for a while, will go back to the same environment that they came from. So
Right. Relapse
is omnipresent.
It is. Unfortunately, something I learned early on, being a parent of a child with an addiction, is you want to do everything you can to help them. You want to do, you know, with any other type of disease, you can, you know, get them treatment and hopefully they recover. Well, with addiction, they may be in recovery, but they're never recovered. And it's something my daughter and many other young people and even adults, older adults in our state will face for the rest of their lives. That's actually one of the things, the perception is that this is, you know, a younger demographic, and I think the statistics will show that that's a larger percentage of the demographic is maybe between, you know, 18 and, and 28. Yet this is a problem that affects every single demographic in our state, in our country. Meeting with an insurance company recently who does Medicare insurance, and they tell me that they're dealing with tens of thousands of senior citizens that are addicted to opioids.
Really?
As well. So it can hit anywhere.
Yeah. So tell me about the bills that were initially passed by you. You've spearheaded so much legislation, and then just this past spring, a whole new series of pieces of legislation that you spearheaded. What have we done in Wisconsin to take on the issue?
So there's been three different cycles of legislation. The first one really Like as I said, I've learned, and I think a lot of other people in our state have learned. And as we've been going here, we originally, you know, heroin got the attention because heroin in small towns like Marinette isn't something you expect. But that's what we were finding. So we initially addressed the heroin epidemic, and that got the headlines. We did things such as providing a Narcan for first responders to be able to reverse the effects of an overdose to save that life. Since then, we've expanded even two or three more times to get more access to that drug that can save that life. We passed the first 911 Good Samaritan law in Wisconsin, where, you know, people were being found left alone, even though in most cases they were using the drugs with friends. They were being left because nobody wanted to get into trouble from law enforcement. So we passed the Good Samaritan law. We did things such as treatment was not accessible in a lot of our more rural parts of the state, so we created three pilot programs in rural and underserved areas. There were seven bills in all in the first session. The second session based on what we had learned the first 2 years, we really focused more on the prescription drugs. And the prescription drug monitoring program was kind of the centerpiece for, in my view, prevention of that prescription drug addiction. So we had passed a prescription drug monitoring program in Wisconsin in the, I believe, 2010 session. And it had been functioning, but it wasn't a requirement for the doctors to check it. The pharmacies had to enter the information for any scheduled drug within, I believe it was 72 hours, or maybe even been longer. I don't completely recall. But that was too long a period of time, and doctors were not required to check that database. So we sat down with the stakeholders, we sat down with the docs, we sat down with the hospital association, all the different, you know, the addiction groups. We, first of all, identified the fact we needed to make the database better and more user-friendly. So we did that. The state Department of Safety and Professional Services done a great job updating that and improving it. So while we're making the improvements, we also now want to make it so that it actually is useful, because at that time only about 18% of our docs were actually using the system. So if the data is there and you're not using it, it's not really delivering on its potential. So we improved it, but then at the same time, as of April of this year, we said on the initial prescription and on refill prescriptions, doctors need to check that database to make sure that their patient is not drug seeking. Perhaps they got that very same prescription from somebody else.
I see.
So this has really made a big difference. So the data is not completely in for this year so far, but I can tell you just the fact that we passed it and implementation was imminent. We saw a significant behavior in Wisconsin in 2016. In the third quarter of 2016, we saw 8 million fewer doses of these controlled substances prescribed.
That's quite a few.
In the fourth quarter, we saw 11 million fewer doses.
Oh, my.
So we're seeing, and that's before, as I said, it became law as of April of this year that has to be checked. So I think that's probably going to be the most significant change to prevent addiction, is to just make sure not to tell docs how they should be prescribing, but to give them the tools to better identify people that might be drug seeking.
Right.
So that was the centerpiece of that second session. This session, we're trying to fill the gaps that exist. That treatment in rural and underserved areas, well, underserved doesn't necessarily mean rural, so we're expanding on the treatment. We're also, you know, looking at ways to, if we're going to invest in treatment, because a lot of these folks are on our Medicaid programs, we're going to invest. We want to make sure the treatment is supported with follow-up. So we're actually developing a recovery school so that children, perhaps high school students that have gone to treatment, that they can continue to get counseling and support once they've completed treatment. And then there is, you know, we've gone further on other things that we've already done, such as the Good Samaritan. We originally had not provided the immunity for the person overdosing, and that was based on a personal decision from my own experience with my daughter and other parents I'd heard from. You may not think the idea of your child being in jail is a good thing, but when you question every night going to bed whether tonight's going to be the night that you get a phone call because they've died of an overdose,
that's right.
Preferential.
Can't imagine.
We wanted to find a way to create a pipeline from if that overdose event's going to take place. We wanted to make sure they got into treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So we're expanding it, but we're expanding it to the person overdosing, but we're also requiring them to enter into deferred prosecution and or a drug treatment program or a drug court program, which have been there's been drug court investments, treatment and diversion investments in each one of these three sessions of bills to continue to expand on the success. You know, success in what does success look like in addiction and in the court system? Typically, prior to treatment and diversion courts, about 100% of every people who had went to prison for these opioid offenses came home, reoffended, and went back to prison. So that's not success.
Right.
Unfortunately, a high success rate in just treatment alone is perhaps maybe 30%. We're seeing in some counties in the state, we're seeing long-term recovery at 60% for these treatment and diversion programs.
Mm.
So, you know, and that's not only makes sense for the individual, it makes sense for the taxpayer, too.
Mm-hmm. Do we have enough money for those treatment programs and for the drug courts?
Well, first of all, I would suggest that the investments we make actually pay for themselves because the reduction in number of corrections, prison days, should go down, and we believe that to be the case. We've actually initial data will, I believe, point that to be true. But if you're saying, could we invest more? I think we could, and we're continuing to do that. We've expanded this the treatment and diversion programs. I believe it's 300% just since 2013. So we're heading in the right direction, but, of course, you could always spend more.
Right. We'll take phone calls for you in a moment. Representative John Nygren is our guest from Assembly District 89, Marinette. He introduced some years ago a number of bills that address the opiate and heroin addiction problem in Wisconsin. It is significant, as you've heard him outline. There's more yet to be done, but he's really introduced a lot of legislation. Our lines are filled, but, you know, eventually you'll have a chance to get through. The number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. You can always leave comments on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls for Representative John Nygren. Zach in Waupaca is your first caller. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say thank you to Representative Nines. I think this has been a really great change. I'm a family physician and I practice in a rural area, and I can see the difference in my patients, in my panel, and it really helps me to practice medicine the way I've wanted to practice all along. So I really, big gratitude to you. One thing that I would challenge you on, Representative Nygren, is, you know, this is a great example of a nonpartisan issue that really benefits the public. And I think if we can continue to do more things like this, we overall as a society will be in a better place.
Yeah. And Zach, before you go, tell me how extensive the problem of opiate and heroin addiction has been in Waupaca.
It has been incredibly extensive, so much so that the community has taken its own initiatives probably 5 to 10 years ago to start to combat some of these issues. Lots of heroin in the small community and lots of methamphetamines. And in the first wave of improvements that we're seeing with this bill, we've really stomped down the opiate prescriptions, which is fantastic, which is really helping some of the heroin issues. But it's really kind of pushed things over to more methamphetamine, which unfortunately there's less treatment options for methamphetamines. And so the Adderalls and the stimulants of the world are really the next hill to tackle.
Representative Nygren.
Yes, actually, we're aware. So, I mean, first of all, a war on drugs, you know, I mean, I recently saw a press release that my staff was going to send out, you know, talking about the winning the war on drugs, and I'm not naive enough to think that we'll ever completely win the war. If we're successful to move to change the behavior, I think that there's something else that's going to come in and fill that void from opioids, and meth is one of those. So when this more recent round of treatment centers that we're investing in the state, we actually have expanded the type of treatment that is available to make sure that we are covering meth and other type of alcohol, other type of addictions that we see in our state. So we're recognizing the fact that this is a shifting target.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zach, for calling in. Pat in Madison, hi.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. I love your show, and we're going to miss you so much, but retirement is great.
Thanks, Pat.
I'm calling because I'm a registered nurse. I've worked most of my 40-year career in Madison. The first 12 years or so, I was an addiction specialist nurse, worked both in detox and treatment. After that, I spent the rest of my career working in various kind of med-surgical things. So I have taken care of a lot of patients with chronic pain. And I speak from a different standpoint in that I am someone who has severe chronic pain that has only been successfully treated with an opiate. And it that's been since 1995. And I had to have a bunch of nerve blocks at the beginning because even the opiates didn't help the pain. But after a few years, it settled down enough that I got good pain relief from a specific dose of opiates. I've stayed on that dose all this time. I take less than I did the first couple years of this injury. This injury happened during surgery. And I've been on the same dose. I have no symptoms of addiction. And there are thousands and thousands of people like me. I talked to one of the doctors I worked with at the time because I was concerned about having to take opiates long term. And he said that based on the research he'd done, and he was an addiction specialist, that only 20 to 30% of people who take opiates for chronic pain become addicted, and the rest of us don't. That's between 70 and 80% of chronic pain patients do not get addicted to these drugs. There's a big difference, of course, I'm sure you know, between physical dependence and addiction. Addiction, one of the hallmarks of addiction is that you seek out more and more medication, that you don't get the high from that drug that so you need more to get back to where you were, to where you want to be. But for people who have chronic pain, you don't get the high. That isn't a side effect of the drug, and especially after the first couple of years, you don't feel any of those kind of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So it is an excellent treatment for those of us who have severe chronic pain, especially from nerve damage pain, that there just is no other way to treat. If they would come up with another way to treat it, that would be great. But I had as many nerve blocks as they dared give me, because the problem with nerve blocks is they also can cross over to causing more damage than that they help, and mine got to that point. So I have lived a very productive life. I never missed any work. I got excellent reviews. I was in bed for 18 months with this pain. And if I didn't have the medication I have now, I would have to live in bed with an ice bag for the rest of my life.
Representative Nygren.
So, I mean, I understand that discussion completely. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the things we did in Wisconsin is we didn't do what some other states have done. Some states have limited the availability, the supply, the number of prescriptions that were allowed. We have not done that. All we've done is given doctors the tools, and we required them to check the database to make sure they have all the information to make decisions that are appropriate for their patients. Are there perhaps doctors that are changing their prescribing habits based on the things we've done here in Wisconsin? Yes, but first of all, it's not required. They might be doing that for other reasons. There is more and more, I'm not an expert on addictionology, but there is more and more studies that are coming out that long-term pain treatment using opioids may not necessarily be the best option. So, you know, not to question anybody, any doctor that might be making that decision. We're just trying to give them the best information that they possibly can to make that decision.
Thank you, Pat. Very nice to hear from you. And let's go to Barbara in Green Bay. Getting short on time, everybody. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Hi. Hello, Representative, and thank you so much for everything that you're doing. I have a couple concerns, but right now my main concern is the cost of treatment, and I'm also listening, you know, the federal things about who's going to pay for what. And just like the tobacco industry, eventually people turned around and said, okay, there needs to be some, you know, stepping up. They've been culpable. And
pharmaceutical, I hate to put words in your mouth, but we're almost out of time. Pharmaceutical should pay as well. Representative Nygren.
You know, I believe that Attorney General Schimmel has actually joined one of them. There might be multiple class action lawsuits, but there is no doubt that addiction to prescription drugs has created a social cost, whether that be to you as a family with an addicted member or to, you know, employers who are dealing with these issues. There's no doubt. So, I mean, I'm supportive of exploring those class action lawsuits to see if there it was wrong done in this move to and growth in the prescription of opioids.
Representative John Nygren, thank you very much for addressing this issue and for being with us.
Thanks for having the conversation.
And we want to thank Colleen Leahy and Gretchen Brown for producing and on-air production of this program. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We'll be with you again mañana, and we'll talk about the road to Camelot, Hour 2.